It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Companies started recalling huge quantities of blood pressure drugs last summer, including some made for Mylan Pharmaceuticals here in Pittsburgh, because of a discovery of cancer-causing properties in the medications. Millions of people take the drugs, valsartan, losartan, and irbesartan. So what happens now? We're joined by cardiologist Dr. Raghu Tadakamala. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Kevin.
And Dr. Raghu is with the Allegheny Health Network. So this started in July. A few months later, Mylan announced its first batch of recalls. And just last week, Pfizer Japan recalled Amvalo, is it? Which was manufactured in Mylan Labs in India. So the question is, how widely prescribed are the medications we mentioned?
These medications are fairly common. They are prescribed to millions of people. But the important thing to know is that not all of the medication has been recalled. Certain lots by certain manufacturers have been recalled. So there still is availability of these medications. And just because you're on one of those doesn't mean your lot has been recalled.
Right. Have you prescribed these drugs yourself in your practice?
Yeah, these are very commonly used blood pressure medications. They're very effective and generally very safe and very tolerated. This class of medications belongs to one of the three groups of medicines that we use first line for treating hypertension or high blood pressure.
And that means what? So you're first diagnosed and your doctor says, let's try this to see if it works in you?
Yeah, exactly. Obviously, we will start lifestyle modifications, healthy diet, exercise, weight loss, smoking cessation, and other factors. But if your blood pressure is high enough, the guidelines recommend we start a medication, and often we'll use one of these medications first.
Let's just remind people how widespread high blood pressure is. Numbers I saw from the CDC were as much as 30% of Americans?
Much higher, actually.
Even that?
Yeah. Ooh. So according to the new guidelines, which revised the definition of hypertension, it's estimated that 46%, almost one in two people in this country or adults will have hypertension or high blood pressure.
And not all of them are getting treated, though, are they?
Yeah. So not everyone even is aware that they have high blood pressure. Only 80% of people with high blood pressure know it. A smaller percentage of that are treated, and an even smaller percentage of that are controlled.
Are people getting sick from these recalled medicines? And what's wrong with the drugs?
Sure. To start with, what's wrong with the drugs? So last summer, it was noted that some of these medications have trace amounts of impurities that presumably are byproducts of the manufacturing process. They're chemicals called NDMA and NDEA, which are known to be carcinogens in humans. In elevated quantities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no adverse effects reported. There's no actual diseases that have been caused by these. And to be honest, the associated risk with them is negligible. The FDA estimates that if you had been on the highest dose of one of these medicines for, we think they've been in the supply for possibly up to 4 years, if you'd been on one of these medicines for 4 years, the highest exposure, the additional risk of a cancer is negligible. It'd be about one case of cancer for 8,000 people. To put that into context, about one in three people get cancer in this country over their lifetime. So if you do the math, you know, 2,700 out of 8,000 people might get cancer off of these medicines. But if you're taking one of these medicines, 2,701 out of 8,000 might get cancer.
What are you hearing from your patients? Are they concerned? Are they asking you, what should I be on?
Yeah, there's lots of questions. You know, one is, you know, what should I do right now? So the, you know, the general recommendation by the FDA is don't stop your medicine because we think the additional risk is negligible and, you know, the risk of stopping your medicine abruptly may be higher. So work with your pharmacist and your physician to find an alternative. Often the alternative will be the same medicine, but made by a different manufacturer. Additionally, there are 8 medications in this class. So it's actually pretty easy to switch to another medication in this class without any real change in side effect profile or efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
The other question people are asking is, what is my risk of cancer? What should I do? And like I said, the additional risk is negligible. So we just recommend what we always recommend: eat well, exercise, live healthy, talk to your doctor about age-appropriate cancer screening. If you're 45, you should have colon cancer screening. If you're of a certain age, you should have breast cancer screening. And talk to your physicians about those things.
Right. Just have a couple minutes left. So you mentioned diet, exercise, lifestyle things. For those seeing a doctor being treated, how common is it to prescribe medication as opposed to let's just do changes in your eating habits and your exercise habits?
We often see reluctance to medications, but I would say it is important to follow the guidelines that are based on good evidence that treating hypertension with medications, if necessary, reduces the risks of heart attacks and strokes. We know that blood pressure damages the arteries themselves, causing a vicious cycle of stiffened arteries and higher blood pressure. And if we don't control the blood pressure well, even if down the road you start becoming a vegan, salt-free, ketogenic marathon runner, you may still be dependent on medications if enough damage has been done. So it's important to control the blood pressure and simultaneously institute lifestyle modifications depending on what your blood pressure is.
These drugs are still being made. So how can you be sure that you have a good batch, that what you have in your medicine cabinet at home is safe to take?
Yeah, so check with your pharmacist. They'll have the lot numbers and the manufacturers and be able to tell you. And you probably would have already gotten notified if there was a recall, but you can check with your pharmacist. But also, I don't want people to become excessively wary or distrustful of the medication pipeline. You know, there are hundreds of millions of prescriptions of medications dispensed in this country, and these recalls are relatively few and far between.
And what do you tell anybody who's a little bit hesitant now to take that medication because of they hear carcinogen and they become alarmed?
Yeah, we just have to have an extensive discussion with the patient. Talk about risks, talk about benefits, talk about cancer, talk about heart attack, talk about stroke. Every patient is different and everyone has different benefits and side effects, and some people benefit, some people don't. We just have to treat every patient individually in the proper fashion.
And to clarify, the problems are caused are not part of the possible side effects. They're actual impurities in the making process?
Correct. Yeah, this is not the medicine itself that's a problem, but a impurity that is a byproduct of the manufacturing process in certain places.
Dr. Raghu Tadakamala is a cardiologist with the Allegheny Health Network. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us today, and happy Valentine's Day to a cardiologist.
Yeah, thank you very much. If you want any more information, you can check me out on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at PagingDrT, or my website, PagingDrT.com.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Under Pennsylvania's charter school law, all schools must be, quote, non-sectarian in all operations. No religious affiliations, no totems or symbols permitted on school grounds. But charter status allows for a lot of flexibility and a steady flow of funding. One local Christian school has decided that the revenue may be more important long-term than its religious identity. Public Source reporter Mary Niederberger joins The Confluence to talk about what's going on with Imani Christian Academy. Welcome back, Mary.
Hi, Megan. Thanks. It's nice to be here.
So Imani is in the city's East Hills neighborhood, serves mostly minority and low-income students, and now its leadership is seeking charter status from Pittsburgh Public Schools. Where does that application stand right now?
Well, the application is in, and the school board last week held a public meeting where the district's review team gave its findings. They find there are some academic shortcomings. They worry about no special education program. They claim that their curriculum is not aligned with the PA core. And they raise concerns about whether or not Imani is going to be able to shed its Christian image. In the application, there's a reference to Christian nuance in the science curriculum. There's a religious studies teacher listed. And it was unclear to me if somehow that got in there by mistake. The head of school said he didn't recall that stuff being in there and he thought it was by mistake. But regardless, it didn't seem like the review team felt that the application, well, they flat out said it didn't include all the information that was required by the state. There were five school directors who expressed some concerns about it. The board is supposed to vote on February 27th, so we'll see what happens.
And those applications, they're not really very flexible. You can't edit them after they're due on that November 15th deadline, can you?
That's the process that the Pittsburgh board has said that they follow, that's the deadline. After that point, there's a public hearing. After that point, there's the review team, there's the findings, and there's the vote.
So tell us a little bit about Imani historically. What are the classes like? Do they have worship services there?
You know, I'm not sure about whether or not they have worship services, and I'm not sure about what their day is like because nobody from the school would talk. But I can tell you from just a little research on the articles that have been written about it, it was founded by a Christian organization, Petra International Ministries and Bishop Donald Clay. A couple of years ago, they parted way with Petra Ministries, but if you look at the mission statement of the school, it talks about a Christian identity and a Christian mission. So clearly, it's part of their day. It's part of what they're doing.
You wrote about all of this for Public Source. What would a true transformation in your mind look like to go from a private religious school to a public charter one?
Well, everybody made it clear, both sides last week, that they understand the charter law. And if it becomes a charter school, it is a public school. So there cannot be any religion in the curriculum. There cannot be any religious icons in the school, any symbols. It has to be totally and completely a secular public school. And the Imani officials say that they are willing to do that if their charter is approved.
Data you collected from Imani's public tax forms suggests that their expenses have way exceeded their income in recent years. Private religious schools tend to rely on that funding mix, tuition, fundraising, sometimes even the state tax credit. How would becoming a charter school change that funding model?
They wouldn't have to do any fundraising. If they become a charter school, they will receive tuition from whatever school district a student comes from. They would receive tuition. They would have a steady flow of revenue. The way charter school tuition is figured, the state sets a number for every school district to pay for its charter school students. So each student that would be enrolled, essentially a tuition check would come with them. It would be steady income. In fact, the review team last week found that in its current state, it looks like Imani may not be fiscally sound because of its IRS filings, but that if it converted to a charter school, it would be fiscally sound because it would have the steady revenue.
And that steady revenue, where would that come from exactly? You write in your stories that the student body isn't entirely made up of Pittsburgh students,
right,
although the school itself does fall within city limits.
Correct. So the money would come from whatever school district the student comes from. So the head of school said that 40 to 45% of the students are Pittsburgh students. So Pittsburgh Public Schools would pay the tuition for them. If it's other nearby communities, I would have to assume it would be Woodland Hills, Penn Hills. Those would be the closest school districts nearby there. So if students came from, or Wilkinsburg, if students came from those school districts would send the tuition funds over to Imani.
It's no secret that public school districts in Pennsylvania don't really have much incentive to approve a charter school application, especially not financially. Is there anything unique about this process for Imani?
I think that in general, the Pittsburgh Public School Board really is usually very thorough and very tough on every single charter application. They have some other outstanding ones that they still have not approved. So that seems to be the tendency, and not just with Pittsburgh, with suburban boards as well, because when they look at a charter application, they're looking to see whether or not that school is really offering something that the school district doesn't already offer. So in this case, you know, there were comments made by some of the school directors that based on what Imani had shown, it's really not offering anything that the school district doesn't already offer.
Except a base in Christian understanding, which maybe they don't want in a public
right.
school.
Right. Well, what they've changed it to, if you would read the in the charter application, they don't call it a Christian mission anymore. They call it a civic leadership curriculum.
And it requires volunteerism, is that
correct? That's correct. Volunteer work, yes.
So there are about 160 charter schools in Pennsylvania right now. Have any others tried this to go from a Christian model or a religious model to a public school?
No. I spoke with Anna Myers, who runs the statewide charter school advocacy organization, and she said there have been some discussions in the Philly area, but it hasn't happened. There are none on this side of the state. We looked at the Baden Academy in Beaver County, but that actually was a Catholic school that closed and there was an empty building, and then the charter operator came along and purchased the building. Now, it's possible that some of the kids from the Catholic school go to the charter school, but it was not a direct conversion the way Imani would be.
You mentioned the Baden building. Imani Christian Academy is currently sitting in the former East Hills Elementary School. You write that there's an addendum in the sale agreement that could actually put up a little bit of a struggle here for this charter application.
That's what the district contends. The district contends that they filed this addendum to the sales agreement that said it can't be used for a charter school. But the Imani attorney said it was never filed with the deed, so it's not enforceable.
Interesting.
There's another twist in this, too, that I wanted to mention, and that is one of the school board members accused Imani of doing it just for the money. And the Imani head of school said it's not about money, it's about access, it's about allowing more kids in. And so I think they have maybe 190-some students now. They would up it to 230 if they were a charter school. But there were questions raised at the school board meeting about whether or not some of the current Imani students would be left out, because charter schools have open enrollment. There's a lottery if there are more students that want in there. And so that's a question, too. I mean, would some of the students who are currently there have to leave the school if it became a charter school?
The school board will vote on the Imani Academy charter application at its February 27th legislative meeting. Mary Niederberger is an education reporter for PublicSource.org. You can find links to her work on our website at WESA.FM. Mary, thanks so much for being here and for keeping us informed.
All right. Thanks, Megan.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
Lots of musicians have visited Springfield through the years, including a special appearance from Sir Elton John on Valentine's Day in 1999.
Mr. John, I'm your biggest fan. I've tape recorded all your songs off the radio.
Oh, that's very sweet.
The husbands of Springfield thought that the singer was hired by Quickie Mart proprietor Apu Nahasapimapetilon to sing a song for his wife, Manjula. However, he was only there due to a malfunctioning chandelier in his private jet. Sir Elton, however, did record a new version of Your Song with lyrics tailored to Apu and Manjula.
My gift is my song, yeah, and this one's from Apu.
For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spihar.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania has one of the highest racial disparities between teachers and students in the country. Only about 6% of teachers are people of color, while students of color make up 33% of enrollment. That trend is true in Pittsburgh as well. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider reports on a program the public school district's leaders hope will diversify the faculty.
Senior Rayson Connor has almost exclusively been taught by white female teachers.
My whole life, I think I've only had like two black male teachers, and I loved them.
Those two men teach music and science in Brashear High School in Beachview. They check in on him often to make sure he's on track in his other courses. Connor is African American, and the African American men in his life have helped him envision what he wants to do after high school.
They always like tell you the truth, but always like make it motivational too. And like, that's like somebody that I want to grow up to be.
More than 85% of Pittsburgh public school teachers are white, and a majority are women. That's compared to the 53% of students who are black. Research shows that students like Connor might be more engaged in classrooms and have a greater chance of graduating if their teachers looked like them and had similar lived experiences. Connor is a successful student. He's been accepted to multiple colleges. He's not sure where he wants to go or what he wants to study, but he is sure that he wants to work with kids. This year, he has spent every afternoon with sixth grade students at Phillips Elementary School on the south side.
Yeah, we're going to start on 19.
The class is reading a book about the Holocaust. Students ask Connor questions about the ways people died and why they were targeted. He helps them with comprehension, and he likes being part of their lives.
Every time I walk into the room, they say, "Yay, Mr. Connor, Mr. Connor." They light up whenever they see you. Like, I like that feeling, you know?
Connor has spent 4 years in high school learning to be a teacher. He's in the Teacher Academy Magnet Program at Brashear. Students take courses on teaching and classroom management alongside their more traditional courses. They spend their senior year assisting an elementary school teacher. The program started in 1989. Enrollment has fluctuated over the years, but there are now about 100 students learning to be teachers. This year's graduating class is made up of all African-American students. The district knows it needs more teachers of color. That's one of the reasons it started this program. But leaders also say it needs more teachers in general. Fewer students are seeking degrees in education. Pennsylvania data show the number of newly issued in-state teaching certificates has dropped by 71% since 2009. Kimberly Saffron, the principal of Brashear, says it's challenging to find science, math, and special education teachers. People with those degrees can get higher paying work outside of teaching.
I mean, we have a lot of work that we need to do as a society, especially in a country, on how we value educators, because we don't value educators in this country. They're not paid well enough personally, and we just don't value the profession.
Pittsburgh Public doesn't have data to show if the program works. It has some anecdotal evidence of graduates coming back to teach in the district. It's also not a unique program. Other districts across the country have created Grow Your Own Teacher programs, and those programs also haven't kept useful data. As a way to better incentivize and track students, Superintendent Anthony Hamlet drafted a memorandum of understanding with the teachers union that would promise a position to the program's graduates. Saffron says if those students come back to teach, it will serve the children in their communities as well.
They're going to have teachers that have had that same lived experience that they have had. Culturally, they're going to be different because of their age, but there's a lot of similarities, and I think it'll bring better outcomes for our students ultimately.
Teaching is challenging. It's not something she says people should be pressured to do. After 4 years in the program, senior Rayson Connor has decided he doesn't want to be a teacher. While it may be cliche, Saffron says teaching is a calling. She hopes the program can help identify some of those called to the field early on. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
A lot of people assume a healthy diet is also good for the environment. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Well, a recent study lends some credence to that conventional wisdom. Lester Graham from Michigan Radio has more.
Researchers at the University of Michigan and Tulane University looked at a large sample of Americans and what they said they ate. Researchers then looked at the nutritional value of that food. Finally, they looked at how much those foods emit greenhouse gases as they were produced on the farm. Martin Heller with the University of Michigan is one of the co-authors of that study released in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. We talked to him by Skype.
What we found is that indeed there is a correlation that diets in the U.S. that are lower in carbon footprint tend to be a bit more healthy, tend to have higher dietary quality than the diets that have a high carbon footprint.
Diets high in red meat, dairy, and solid fats had the largest carbon footprints. That's in part because of the digestive system of animals such as cattle.
The biology that allows them to eat grass also produces methane as a byproduct, which is a powerful greenhouse gas emission, 25 times that of carbon dioxide, and is what really hits beef and other ruminant animals hard in the carbon footprint standpoint.
People concerned about their impacts on climate change have long felt the food they choose has a connection to climate change. Joel Panazzo co-owns the Lunchroom Diner and Canteen and the Detroit Street Filling Station. Both are vegan restaurants. They get some of their customers from the nearby Ann Arbor Farmers Market.
When they're holding their giant bag of groceries and they're walking in here, I think that's when they're connecting the two. Like, I just bought this from the farmer that has the farm 20 miles down the road. And then I think that's the moment when they ask, where are you getting your food?
The researchers looked at the carbon footprint of the products on the farm. But Panazzo says people also want to know whether the food they eat is being trucked across the country.
Folks are considering, like, all the resources that have to go into the food. And when you consider meat products and other dairy products, you can start to see the amount of all of the traveling and trucking of our agricultural items, all that goes into producing a meat or a dairy product.
Now, there are a couple of caveats the study notes. Some of the low-emission foods are not all that healthy, such as added sugars and refined grains. And while plant-based diets are considered more healthy, they can be lower in some nutrients, such as iron and calcium. Diets are complex, and the researchers stress the findings are nuanced. The one thing that was clear to Martin Heller and his colleagues...
In general, we're not eating very healthily here in the U.S. There certainly are opportunities for us to both improve the nutritional health of our diet along with reducing the environmental impact associated with providing that diet.
A companion study to this one found 20% of Americans account for almost half of the diet-related greenhouse gas emissions. I'm Lester Graham.
There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection. Nina Simone, Why the King of Love is Dead.
We want to do a tune written for today, for this hour, for Dr. Martin Luther King.
Nina Simone first performed Why the King of Love is Dead at the Westbury Music Fair in New York. The date was April 7th, 1968, 3 days after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The song had been written 24 hours earlier by Simone's bassist, Gene Taylor. Simone captured Dr. King's compassion and commitment.
But he had seen the mountaintop. And he knew he could not stop. Always living with the threat of death ahead.
And she expressed the sorrow and the rage of civil rights activists.
What's gonna happen now in all of our cities? My people are rising. They're living in lies, even if they have to die. Even if they have to die at the moment that they know what life is.
Why the King of Love is Dead was released on the live album Nuff Said, an album dedicated to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to WYEP.org/Black History Month.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Contemporary craft has long been a cutting-edge art space, taking on traditional crafts including fabric art, ceramics, metalwork, and often hosting classes and exhibits by internationally known artists. The group is leaving its current space in the produce terminal area of the Strip District. So what's coming next? WESA's arts and culture reporter Bill O'Driscoll is at their new site right now, and he joins us by phone from Upper Lawrenceville. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Kevin.
So, Bill, how's the new space? It's your first glimpse, too. What do you think?
Yeah, well, they're having their big announcement this morning in a couple minutes here. It's a big old industrial space. It was a manufacturing facility. It's up in Upper Lawrenceville, so it's like at 57th and Butler Street, and it's cavernous. It's empty. It's very raw right now, but they have plans to turn it into a big, gallery, exhibition, workshops, classroom, and offices.
Mm-hmm. So how does it compare to the Strip District space that was in the produce terminal? Bigger, smaller, same vibe, what?
It's about the same size. It's just a little bit smaller in terms of square footage, but it's mostly on one floor. I think the previous building, which was the previous space, which was quite large at the very end of the produce terminal, they had some basement areas there that they used for classes and things. It looks like here they'll be able to do most of it on one floor. The big difference really is the neighborhood. Instead of being right in the middle of the Strip District there, they'll be in this end of Lawrenceville where it's more like industrial. There's a lot of car repair places. They're right by that place that kind of looks like an oil refinery, if you know that spot,
right off
the 62nd Street Bridge, the R.D. Fleming Bridge. So it's there's not as much going on up here in this end of Lawrenceville right now, but who knows what's going to happen in the next few years.
So it's not developed. It's sort of like a blank canvas, so to speak. They get to really be creative in developing their new home.
Yeah, it's a $5.5 million project, they say. That's to purchase the building, which will be a big advantage for them. They won't be leasing anymore as they were in the produce terminal. But the $5.5 million includes buying the building, doing all the renovations, the architectural fees and all stuff like that. So they can really, they really do have a kind of a blank canvas here with this building, which is, poised to be what Lawrenceville folks hope will be like a new gateway to the neighborhood.
You mentioned Upper Lawrenceville and the industrial component, but Upper Lawrenceville doesn't really get the foot traffic that the Strip District does. How might this affect their patronage? People coming in, viewing the art?
Yeah, it could. I'm going to ask them about that after they do their announcement here. Obviously the Strip gets a lot of traffic for other reasons. People go into restaurants, nightclubs, and things down there. That you're not going to get so much up here. It would have to be more of like a destination, but they're hoping, they're only a few blocks really from the center of things in Lawrenceville, all the nightlife and the boutiques down there. So they're really not that far from that area. And I'm thinking they're hoping that by being here, they'll help kind of extend Butler Street, if you will, as a real destination.
And Bill, remind us why the move is necessary.
Right, because there's a big redevelopment project happening at terminal buildings. They were told, the Contemporary Craft was told last summer, as were many of the other tenants there, that they had to be out. Contemporary Craft actually has an agreement where they can stay till the end of this year through December, and then they have to vacate. And so that's why they had to leave.
So when they open up their new home, will attendance continue to be free? Do we know that yet?
I think that's their plan. Yeah, they haven't announced otherwise, but that's part of their goal is to be really accessible to the community. As far as that, they've always been had free admission to the space there, and that's been a big benefit to the community, to the arts community, for shows like their big Fiber Arts International show, which is coming up, and that'll be their last show in the current space.
Well, how does this move affect, does it affect Contemporary Craft's mission? They've been around since 1971.
Right, 1971 and since 1986 in the Strip District location. I think they would argue that it's going to expand their mission. They have control of the building now. Again, they'll own the building rather than leasing it, and they'll be doing a lot of the same things they were before. I think they would argue it would give them a lot more flexibility and, also helps them, again, set up in this part of town where arts and kind of culture are starting to are continuing to expand. So they have a chance to sort of stake a claim in this part of the neighborhood where there's not as much going on right now.
And briefly, Bill, what will you be looking for, hoping to hear in the announcements there at 10 o'clock, just minutes away?
Yeah, I think they're going to talk about, the move. There's certainly an economic component to it. They say they have they obviously bring a lot of artists into the city to do exhibitions here and things like that. A lot of out-of-town visitors to the space just to see the art. pardon me. So, they're going to be talking about that and, all the things that they hope it'll do for the neighborhood and the ways that Contemporary Craft hopes that it will benefit the group as a whole. Oh, they're just turning the lights on here in this room that I was hiding in for quiet. And it's, there's still the old work sink back here. It's really just that big empty industrial space, but there's an old work sink in the back here, and it's all stripped out. And
already, Bill.
Like ventilation ducts and stuff like that. It's kind of cool.
We'll let you get to it, and we'll look for your coverage on All Things Considered this afternoon and at WESA.FM. Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's Arts and Culture Reporter. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, man.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Pittsburgh is known for its historically ethnic neighborhoods. Think the Italians of Bloomfield or the Polish of Polish Hill. But one area of downtown has an ethnic history that is less apparent. WESA listener Jason Holworth asked a good question.
What happened to the Pittsburgh Chinatown?
So 90.5 WESA's Kathleen Davis found out.
Our story starts in Beaver County in 1872, about 30 miles northwest of Pittsburgh. Manufacturing was big in western Pennsylvania, and these factories were dependent on migrants and immigrants. About 300 Chinese laborers came to work at the Beaver Falls Cutlery Factory, making knives and forks. Around this time, Pittsburgh's Chinatown started to grow. According to the Pittsburgh Press newspaper, by 1900, about 180 ethnically Chinese people lived in Pittsburgh, most if not all within a few square blocks downtown, on and between Grant Street, 2nd and 3rd Avenues, and Ross Street. Marion Lien, president of Pittsburgh's chapter of the Organization of Chinese Americans, says this community flourished, operating laundries and restaurants.
These were the very jobs that were available to them. Society at that time wasn't comfortable with a group that didn't look like them, didn't speak the language that they understood.
Eventually, the restaurants gained popularity among white Pittsburghers. A report from 1903 said you could get a bowl of rice for 5 cents or pick the priciest item on the menu for $1.50. At Chinatown's height in the early 1920s, an estimated 500 Chinese people called it home. Ruth Yi grew up there in the 30s.
We're all born at home. Five of us was born on the third floor on 2nd Avenue, downtown Pittsburgh. When my father came to this country, he only had $50 in his pocket. And he came with my mother and my brother, who was 5 years old.
She says she remembers growing up in Pittsburgh fondly, but there was discrimination. She says a lot of this was linked to Japanese exclusion during World War II.
We were not allowed to go to Kenwood Park because, you know, being Chinese, they thought we were Japanese, you know, that they didn't let us go in.
Not much remains of Pittsburgh's Chinatown. Construction of the Boulevard of the Allies in the 1920s cut through the neighborhood, prompting Chinese Pittsburghers to leave for other communities and the suburbs. By 1959, about 30 residents remained. Today, only one restaurant marks where the neighborhood once stood. The Chinatown Inn on 3rd Avenue has an ornate pagoda-style entrance and roof, painted in red and blue. But that doesn't mean Chinese culture has faded away. At the Heinz History Center earlier this month, dozens of brightly clad dancers, musicians, and martial artists participated in the Year of the Golden Pig kickoff celebration. Lunar New Year is a Chinese holiday that lasts for about 2 weeks. The local event was organized in part by Lien. She says the celebration helps young people of Asian and Pacific Islander descent express their identities.
To know where you come from really shows you the roadmap for where you are going to head next.
Alan Peng of Robinson Township is also with Pittsburgh's Organization of Chinese Americans, or OCA. At the celebration, he performed Kung Fu and Tai Chi, and later drummed with OCA's Lion Dance Team. He's been involved with the organization since 2006, and says discovering Chinese cultural performance after growing up in Steubenville, Ohio, was a big deal for him.
Growing up in the U.S., in some areas where they don't really have much Chinese culture, this was like a huge eye-opener for me, and I just wanted to reconnect with my heritage.
The participants in Chinese cultural events aren't just Chinese, and Lien says this is a conscious choice. The celebration featured a Korean pop music performance and Bhutanese dance.
In coming together as an Asian Pacific American group, we have found that our disparate voices become stronger when we are together.
Pittsburgh's Lunar New Year Parade will take place Sunday in Squirrel Hill, starting at 11 a.m. Kathleen Davis, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we'll speak with Governor Tom Wolf about raising teachers' salaries, the minimum wage, and legalizing marijuana. Plus, a conversation with Pittsburgh native actor Jeff Goldblum about his first love, playing jazz on the piano. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, happy Valentine's Day, and hope you have a good day of good news.